Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear stories from Anna Mateo and Mario Ritter. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Mario Ritter.
The United States and South Korean Air Forces are holding one of their largest ever joint exercises. The 5 days of exercises are named Vigilant Ace. South Korean troops are training with more than 230 airplanes and 12,000 members of the U.S. Armed Forces. The planes include a number of U.S. stealth warplanes. The high-technology aircraft are designed to avoid discovery by radar. The exercises began less than 1 week after North Korea tested its most advanced long-distance missile. The North Korean government said it launched an intercontinental ballistic missile, or ICBM, last Tuesday. The Hwasong-15 rocket traveled farther than any of the country's earlier rockets. The new rocket was said to be able to reach anywhere in the United States. However, experts are wondering whether the missile is ready to carry a nuclear weapon. Some say the North needs months or years before it can develop a missile equipped to carry a warhead to a target without burning up. South Korea has yet to confirm that the Hwasong-15 missile successfully re-entered the atmosphere. South Korea's Unification Ministry spokesman, Baek Tae-hyun, told reporters Monday that "We are making efforts to resolve the North's nuclear issue peacefully with the international community." But he added, the government does not accept the North's unilateral claim to completing its nuclear program. In July, South Korean President Moon Jae-in said that North Korea's possession of a fully operational ICBM would represent a red line for possible military action. U.S. officials have warned that they will not let North Korea threaten the South with a nuclear missile. The North Korean government denounced the military exercises this week. The country has long said that such activities are preparations for an attack. North Korea's state-operated Korean Central News Agency warned that the United States was driving the Korean Peninsula to the brink of war. This weekend, U.S. officials voiced concerns about the intensity of tensions. H.R. McMaster serves as National Security Advisor to President Donald Trump. McMaster said on Saturday that the chance of war with North Korea is increasing with every day. The president has threatened to act against North Korea if it attacks the United States or its allies. In November, the U.S. government again placed North Korea on its state sponsors of terrorism list. That move permits adding to already highly restrictive trade sanctions against the North. Ralph Kosa is president of Pacific Forum CSIS, a private foreign policy research center. He said that military action, with its deadly results for South Korea, is only one idea for answering the North's tests. Red line responses don't have to be military, but they should be significant and painful, politically and economically, if not militarily, said Kosa. However, the Defense Department has said the North's tests are not yet a threat to the United States mainland. The government has set up missile defense systems in South Korea and Guam, as well as the states of Alaska and California, in an effort to protect the U.S. and its allies. North Korea's neighbors, China and Russia, have supported a plan called dual suspension. Under the proposal, the United States and South Korea would halt military exercises in exchange for North Korea stopping its weapons programs. China's foreign minister, Wang Yi, said the 2 months in which North Korea did not test a missile had not been effectively used for diplomacy. He said that the parties involved in tensions on the Korean Peninsula had not grasped the window of opportunity. I'm Mario Ritter.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Health and Lifestyle Report. The year 2018 will mark the 100th anniversary of the deadliest influenza outbreak in history. Scientists estimate that the influenza pandemic of 1918 killed more than 50 million people around the world. Other estimates go much higher. Because of a lack of medical record keeping, we may never know the exact number. However, the outbreak was a global disaster, killing more people than World War I. In the United States, historians at the National Archives state that the flu afflicted over 25% of the U.S. population. In 1 year, the average life expectancy in the United States dropped by 12 years. It was a fast killer. Again, archival records state that some victims died within hours of their first symptoms. Others died after a few days. Their lungs filled with fluid and they suffocated to death. The 1918 flu pandemic was also different from other outbreaks. It struck many healthy young people. Viruses usually affect sick or old people. Scientists now say they know why. In 1918, people born after 1889 were most at risk because they had not been exposed to an earlier virus as children. This exposure would have protected them somewhat
from the 1918 flu. Although modern medicine effectively controls many diseases, influenza remains difficult to protect against. The World Health Organization estimates that every year, influenza kills 250,000 to 500,000 people around the world. Each year, medical scientists develop flu vaccines, but they can only guess which strain of the virus will spread. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in the United States notes on its website that flu viruses are constantly changing. They can change from one season to the next, or they can even change within the course of one flu season. Flu vaccines offer immunity from a limited number of influenza viruses, and often do not protect against new forms of the virus. The CDC adds that the effectiveness of a flu vaccine can be very different from year to year. The CDC says recent studies show that flu vaccination reduces the risk of flu illness by between 40% and 60% among the overall population. However, this only happens during seasons when most circulating flu viruses are well matched to the flu vaccine. Anthony Fauci is the director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases in the United States. He says the effectiveness or efficacy of flu vaccines makes it worth getting vaccinated. But he says we need a better vaccine.
Even on a good year, the overall efficacy of an influenza vaccine is about 60%. So even though it is always better to get vaccinated against influenza than it is not to get vaccinated, no doubt about that, we need to get a better vaccine.
Vaccine makers are also concerned with the low rate of effectiveness for flu vaccines. David Vaughn is the senior vaccine development leader for influenza and dengue vaccines at the drug company GlaxoSmithKline. Vaughn says becoming infected with influenza remains very common.
The disease we're trying to prevent is very prevalent. Up to 20% of us will have an influenza infection during the course of a year.
Health officials remain concerned about another flu pandemic. New strains of the flu virus appear regularly. One example was the swine flu, or H1N1, outbreak in 2009. Fauci says that virus caused a true pandemic.
Certainly, we've had a flu pandemic in 2009, the H1N1 swine flu, that was not a serious epidemic in the sense of a lot of deaths. It was a pandemic, to be sure, because it was a relatively new virus that was widespread infection throughout the world.
However, outbreaks do not affect all parts of the world equally. Vaughn notes that pandemics hit the developing world harder because of low vaccination rates.
Most influenza deaths occur in developing countries, and very few vaccinations occur there.
To stop the next pandemic, scientists are now researching how to create a universal influenza vaccine. In October 2017, Vanderbilt University Medical Center in the U.S. announced the Universal Influenza Vaccine Initiative. The university said researchers are leading an international effort to develop a universal influenza vaccine that would protect everyone against all strains of the flu anywhere in the world. The university added that researchers will begin tests in early 2018. The Human Vaccines Project, a public-private partnership, is funding the project. However, until a universal influenza vaccine is available, today's seasonal flu vaccine remains important. Experts say that they may prevent the spread of the flu virus and may lower the risk of a deadly pandemic like the one in 1918. I'm Ana Mateo.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in Special English. I'm Steve Ember. In May of 1787, a group of America's early leaders met in the city of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. They planned to amend the Articles of Confederation. That document established a loose union of the 13 states. Instead, they wrote a completely new constitution. It created America's system of government and recognized the rights of its citizens. Last week, we talked about the debate at the convention over the Virginia Plan. The plan was prepared by James Madison and other delegates from the state of Virginia. It described a national government with a supreme legislature, executive, and judiciary. Some delegates feared that such a central government would take away power from the states. But in the end, they approved the proposal. On June 1st, they began debate on the issue of a national executive. It seemed every delegate at the Philadelphia Convention had something to say about the issue. They had been thinking about it for some time. Almost every delegate was afraid to give the position extended powers. Almost no one wanted America's chief executive to become as powerful as a king. Still, many of the delegates had faith in the idea of a one-person executive. Others demanded an executive of three people. James Wilson of Pennsylvania argued for a single executive. He said the position required energy and the ability to make decisions quickly. He said these would best be found in one person. Edmund Randolph of Virginia disagreed strongly. He said he considered a one-person executive as the fetus of monarchy. John Dickinson of Delaware said he did not denounce the idea of having a government headed by a king. He said a monarchy was one of the best forms of government in the world. However, in America, he said, a king was out of the question. The debate over the size of the executive leadership lasted a long time. Finally, the delegates voted for a one-person executive. The question of how to limit power was a major part of the delegates' conversation, according to Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas.
We're still talking about what are the limits of the national government? What is the role of the national government? How do we protect individual rights and individual liberties, etc.?
And he says that question continues to be asked in America today. During the debate at the convention, other questions about the national executive arose. One question was the executive's term. Should the executive serve just once, or could that person be re-elected? Alexander Hamilton argued for a long term of office. He said, if a president served only a year or two, America soon would have many former presidents. These former presidents, he said, would fight for power. and that would be bad for the peace of the nation. Benjamin Franklin argued for the right of re-election. The people, he said, were the rulers of a republic, and presidents were the servants of the people. If the people wanted to elect the same president again and again, they had the right to do this. In the final document, the president's term was set at 4 years with re-election permitted. Next came the question of how to choose the president. It was a most difficult problem. The delegates debated and voted, and then re-debated and re-voted on a number of proposals. James Wilson proposed that the executive be elected by special representatives of the people called electors. Several delegates disagreed. They said the plan would be too difficult to carry out and would cost too much money. One delegate proposed that the president be elected by the state governors. He said the governors of large states would have more votes than the governors of small states. Nobody liked this proposal, especially delegates from the small states. Another proposal was to have the president elected directly by the people. Elbridge Gerry of Massachusetts was shocked by this idea. "The people do not understand these things," he said. "A few dishonest men can easily fool the people." The worst way to choose a president, he said, would be to have him elected by the people. The convention voted on the issue 60 times. In the end, the delegates agreed that the president should be chosen by electors named by state legislatures. Now someone said, "We have decided how to choose the president, but what are we to do if he does bad things after being chosen? We should have some way of dismissing that person." Yes, the delegates agreed, it should be possible to try the president, and if he is found guilty, remove him from office. Governor Morris of Pennsylvania spoke in support of the right of impeachment should the president be persuaded to betray his trust. The delegates approved a proposal for removing a president found guilty of bribery, treason, or other high crimes. The last major question about executive authority was the question of veto power over the national legislature. Not one delegate was willing to give the president complete power to reject new laws, and yet they felt he should have some voice in the lawmaking process. If this were not done, they said, the office of president would have little meaning, and the national legislature would have the power of a dictator. James Madison offered a solution. "The president should have the power to veto a law," Madison said, "but his veto could be overturned if most of the members of the legislature voted to pass the law again." The final convention document listed more details about the office. For example, it said the president had to be a natural-born citizen of the United States or a citizen at the time the Constitution was adopted. The president must have lived in the United States for at least 14 years and be at least 35 years old. The executive would be paid, but the pay could not be increased or reduced during the term in office. The president would be commander-in-chief of the armed forces and, from time to time, report to the legislature on the State of the Union. The final document also gave the words by which a president would be sworn in. Every 4 years, for more than 200 years now, each president has repeated this oath of office. I do solemnly swear that I will faithfully execute the office of the President of the United States and will, to the best of my ability, preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States. Another major issue debated by the convention was a national judiciary, a federal system of courts and judges. The delegates knew a lot about the issue. 34 of them were lawyers. 8 were judges in their home states. One question hung heavy in the air. The states had their own courts and judges. Did the national government need its own system too? Several delegates said no. Roger Sherman of Connecticut said existing state courts were enough. Besides, he said, a system of national courts would be too costly. John Rutledge of South Carolina opposed a national system of lower courts, but he argued for a Supreme Court. Eventually, the convention voted for both. There would be a Supreme Court and a system of lower courts. These courts would hear cases involving national laws, the rights of American citizens, and wrongdoing by foreign citizens in the United States. State courts would continue to hear cases involving state laws. The next question concerned the appointment of national judges. Some delegates believed judges should be appointed by the legislature. Others believed they should be appointed by the president. James Wilson argued in support of having one person appoint judges. He said experience showed that large bodies could not make appointments fairly or openly. John Rutledge disagreed strongly. By no means, he said, should the president appoint judges. He said that method looked too much like monarchy. Benjamin Franklin then told a funny little story. In Scotland, he said, he understood that judges were appointed by lawyers. They always chose the very best lawyer to be a judge. Then they divided that person's cases among themselves. The delegates voted on the issue. They agreed that the legislature could decide how many judges would sit on the Supreme Court. The president would appoint the judges. The legislature could establish lower courts from time to time. The president would appoint those judges too. The issues involving the executive and the federal courts were serious questions that most delegates felt strongly about. But the most hotly debated issue of the convention was still to come.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.